Guys, if you haven't checked up on our social media recently, what have you been doing? I'm at Nick Hardwick, and Jamie is at jamie.hardwick. That's J-A-Y-M-E with a period and then Hardwick, which is not to be confused with the other Jamie Hardwick, who I tagged a little while ago on Instagram, and she notified me that you may want to get this straight, bud. Your wife may be pissed at you. That earned me the Worst Husband of the Week award. Sorry, babe. Anyway, you guys know that Lose Like Alignment is going off. I'm sure you've seen some of the ads circulating. Hundreds of men now are losing staggering amounts of weight on a daily basis. It's been so awesome to see. And of course, I had no idea that life would turn into this for me or for us. I just had to get the information out of my head, share it with others, see if it could help people reclaim their lives. And lo and behold, it has. And I am just really grateful to be a part of this amazing team. And the most fulfilling thing for me and the program is the weekly interactions that we get through the accountability network. So sign up for that. It is awesome to get personal connections and have conversations and get to understand who people are, what their challenges are, and assist on a very personal basis, on a weekly basis. So as this was all going on, we're getting crazy amounts of requests from the ladies wondering if this program is good for them too. And for me, I said, sure, yeah, it is. But really, since the beginning, I've tried to get Jamie to give my plan a try, and she would try it for a day or two and then basically tell me it wasn't for her. And finally, listening to the request on social media and through email for a female version, and then getting some feedback back from females who were actually in the program and taking that into account, and then asking and not telling Jamie what can make this plan work for her and for other females, she went, took the parts from the men's program that she liked, modified it to accommodate the female body and your guys' individual preferences, and gave it a try. And I tread lightly saying this to her. Thankfully, she's not around right now. But it's been super cool watching her own this program. She has gained control back over the food, has reset her hunger cues, and has lost the weight she's been trying to lose, really, forever. I know. Believe me, I don't think she has anything to lose either. But still, she's getting to a place where she feels great about her body. And that is important. In fact, I just get out of the bathroom and she says, I've lost this weight, but Nick, I've lost an inch off of my waist. She's taken measurements. So we sent the adjustments back to our design team, and voila, the Lose Like a Lady program is born. We would love for you guys to join the team. If you want to know more, all food preferences and eating styles work within the framework we provide in both the men's and the women's program. We do provide body weight only workouts and daily activities known as every hour on the hour exercises, EHO. But guess what? As we tell everyone, the exercise is the least important component of the plan. It's not required to lose weight. If you don't want to exercise, or you've got your own form of exercise that you would rather do, do that. We are never going to discourage that. This program will help you figure out what works best for you. You're going to learn appropriate caloric loads for the day and per meal. You're going to learn how to match your caloric intake with daily activity levels. You're going to break free from the having to eat a meal every 3 hours cycle. It really is an incredibly empowering experience. Also, the program helps build healthy self-care habits that make the program sustainable for life. And it's wonderful when you figure out that the more you take care of yourself, the healthier, the easier it is to make good choices when it comes to food, when it comes to exercise. And the best part about the program that a lot of people find is it's 4 weeks on and 2 weeks off of the plan. That is what we call a diet break. How many programs encourage you to not do the diet? We do that so you're going to build trust with yourself. You're going to take the skills you learned and you're going to put them to test in the real world. The whole process, it's incredibly empowering. When you reclaim your health, you really do reclaim your life. Join our teams. Sign up at hardwick.life. It's like hardwick.com, but hardwick.life. And use the code podcast20 for 20% off the order. And by the way, you can use that code forever on anything site-wide forever. And we want you to know that we're here for you. You can email me directly at nick@nickhardwick.com. I do. I get back to everybody. Try it. Try me. I'll get back to you. Anything you have. Show recommendations, any questions, any support, any criticism. We're here for that. Throw everything my way. You need help modifying this program to suit your particular needs? All you got to do is ask. We've helped hundreds of people make this program work in their lives, and you can too. All right, guys, back to the show. Check it out, hardwick.life, podcast 20 for 20% off, and we hope to see you on the network soon. Love you guys. Welcome to the Hardwick Life Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Hardwick. Joining us today is a very special man, a friend of mine, Doc Jacobs, Daniel Doc Jacobs. We got to do this guy justice, guys. He is a freaking hero, like literally a decorated war hero. He is an awesome, awesome dude. Doc is a 35-year-old medically retired Navy corpsman. He served 8 years and 2 months in the U.S. Navy. He served 6 years and 6 months of this service as a combat wounded corpsman. Doc was sent to 3rd Battalion, 7th Marine Regiment, just weeks prior to their deployment in Ramadi, Iraq, and that was in the September of 2005. Doc was in combat for 6.5 months on a 7-month deployment when his gun truck was struck by an IED that consisted of 355-millimeter artillery rounds. And up until that point, Doc had over 225 combat patrols. After 2 full years of physical, mental, and spiritual recovery, which included losing his left leg below the knee, 3 toes from his right foot, and 3 partial fingers from his left hand, Doc returned to the Fleet Marine Force and became one of the few in the Navy to do that. Not only was Doc one of the few amputees to return to the Fleet Marine Force for the Navy, but he also made U.S. Naval and Marine Corps history by being the first amputee corpsman and of all naval personnel to ever be assigned to an infantry unit. And Doc had to fight really hard for that. He's a highly decorated veteran here in the Bronze Star with Valor, Purple Heart, Navy Marine Corps Achievement Medal for saving 59 U.S. coalition forces lives, combat action ribbon, 2 Navy good conduct medals, a personal letter from the former 43rd U.S. President George Bush, being invited to the White House by the 44th U.S. President Barack Obama, a personal upper deck baseball card, and the 2015 Tommy Lasorda Veteran of the Year Award, and in recognition for his outstanding service to both the nation and the community, the city of San Diego recognized him by making November 17th Doc Jacobs Day. How cool is that? Doc has a fantastic book out now called There and Back Again. There and Back Again highlights the ups and downs of a wounded warrior in a post-war, post-injury world. This is the story of how one Navy corpsman persevered after losing his friends and body parts in Ramadi, Iraq. This is not a war story. It begins as Doc Jacobs lies in a hospital bed after a bomb blasts his whole life into a completely new reality. And focusing on the importance of self-discipline and perseverance, There and Back Again, stories from a combat Navy corpsman reveals Doc's path to finding himself and learning to enjoy life again. And after struggling through bureaucratic injustice and frustration, he becomes determined to reach those living with a disability, their family members, and their loved ones, to prove that these wounded warriors, they are enough, and to inspire them to follow their dreams and to find their purpose. Doc now leads the Doc Jacobs Foundation, whose purpose is to provide sports scholarships to assist with the cost of participation and attendance in sports programs for children of active military and veterans families and such children's immediate families. Doc really does amazing work in this world. He is an inspiring human being. I can't wait for you guys to hear his story. Buy the book, There and Back Again, Amazon, wherever you get your books, and check out the work that he does at DocJacobsFoundation.org. Thank you guys for the time. Doc.
What's going on, brother?
How are you, buddy?
Good. How are you?
I am fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah, I've been seeing all your workout posts, man. You're crushing it.
Oh gosh, it's trying to be gentle on myself but get the work done at the same time, you know.
Yeah. I see that it's a lot of like stretch bands and like a lot of like natural movement, a lot of like your body weight kind of stuff, which is
Yeah. That's all. You know what? It's like, I'm done moving men against their will. 300 pounders, 350 pounders. Sometimes the guys were 400 pounds. It made sense at that point to do a lot of loading and being huge. And at this point, I have zero interest in, if I fight somebody, I'm going to lose a lot of money. I'm going to get sued. So thanks, but no thanks there. And I'm going to get hurt, and I don't have any interest in either of those things. So, you know, it's part of, we'll get into this with you too. Like, part of my thing is now like accepting my limitations. And I just, there's been so many instances lately where I'm trying to do things that I can do, but should I be doing them? And I don't know, you know, and it's that towing that fine line between having fun and pushing myself, but at the same time, like trying to have some semblance of longevity. So I want to be around to see my kids, you know, I want to meet my grandkids and my great grandkids. And I want to be physically in a good place so mentally I can be in a good place. And I worry about that all the time. And, you know, I got off the phone with a buddy who's facing a hip replacement, and he's 37 years old. And here I am telling you about this. So you've been through the ringer.
Yeah. Well, like you said, it's the longevity. And I have a lot of my doctor friends that are like, hey, you've been through a lot, like just accept what you've gone through, live life now, like you've done your time and go live. But to your point, I was texting Noel LaMontagne. I don't know if you know. Yeah, we're texting, and I became good friends with him through MVP. And I was showing him like a hex bar video, and he was like, better you than me, bro. He basically said the same thing that you said, like those days are gone. Like, I have no need for that. Like, I'm not trying to guard somebody or push somebody, you know? So he's like, no, bro, not for me anymore.
Yeah. It was probably, gosh, last summer I was training with Philip Rivers because he moved to town and was getting ready, and they couldn't train at their facility because of COVID. So he came up to our clubhouse just right up the road from me, and we got a decent weight room up there. I mean, nothing like high performance or anything, but we were doing hex bar deadlifts, and I was jerking around, and I ended up getting a 500 pounder, and then my back's all wonky, and I'm like, well, that was cool, but for what? Like, you, same thing Noel said. It's like, you've already, or your doctor friend says, like, you've already been there. You've proven everything you need to prove. Like, what else is there? So let me ask you, like, cause we'll just get right into it. And I really want to get into the book, and great job. Great, great job on that. But take me through, well, let's back up, and we'll get to the injuries, and we'll get to life now and where it's going and everything. But you know, what's life been like since the book's been released?
It's been pretty good, pretty hectic actually, in a good way. I've had a lot of veterans reach out to me asking me just for guidance and help, and then I have a lot of just with their story, like they say I'm inspirational and blah blah blah. But it's also been kind of a good thing in a sense that I've been able to create more writing projects. I have another book with a publisher. I'm writing another fellow amputee's biography, but she was never in the military. And then a female Marine friend of mine, she wants me to help write her story. So I'm going to co-author that. And then Hamza Abdullah, we're working on a project together. So it's been great. And I'm really, really blessed for that. And that transition that I never thought would happen. So I hated reading when I was a kid. I was like your typical, you know, jock. I'm like, I just want to go get in good enough grades, play sports, get out there, shine in sports, get a scholarship for sports. And then that was it. But now I'm like kind of a geeky nerd. I'm reading books and endorsing books, and it's incredible, man.
Did you ever see yourself, even several years ago, I know we when we met in late 2016, early 2017, kind of anticipation of climbing Mount Kilimanjaro, I don't even know if a book was on the horizon. And that was 5 years ago. And now look at you, you're a full-blown author. You're, I don't want to say you're ghostwriting, but you're co-authoring books. I mean, that's incredible. How did this become the thing?
Well, so when I had a lot of self-doubts in my story because, as you know, with the backdated Bronze Star, which we'll get into that later because there's a whole lot more to that. I had a lot of doubts in my story. And so my dad just told me to write everything as I went, like a journal almost. And so I didn't want to get it published. I just wanted it to be more of a story for my kids. And because my great grandfather came home from World War II, he was a Darby's Ranger. He was combat wounded and missing in action, and then awarded a Bronze Star and Purple Heart, just like myself, which I take great pride in.
Yeah.
But he never really shared his stories. And so those are gone. And so I didn't want that to happen if I got in a car accident, 6 months from now. Like, I wanted my story to be told so my kids would have that legacy, other than like seeing a box with a bunch of medals in it without the stories to go with it. So, so that's kind of how that came to be. And then a lot of people were pushing me to share the story. And then I finally came to an ending, and which I won't do spoiler alert, but I finally
came read to the book, people, read the book.
Yeah. And then, so then I had my welcome aboard call with the publisher, Kohler Books, and he said, when you go to your website, create a page called Books. I was like, no, I'm done. Books. You're like,
wait, plural?
Yeah. I was like, no, singular. And I said, no, I just wrote 368 pages. I don't want to write anymore. Like, that's a lot. That took me 10 years. And
is that so what it was?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It took me about 10 years to complete that. And so he said, no, just trust me, you're not done. So I did it just to make him happy. And then I was at Padres Fantasy Camp last year. And so it was like right at the beginning of COVID. I was at Padres Fantasy Camp, and I had these weird dreams about karma, purgatory, and witchcraft, which was like insane, right? And so I tell my grandma, I'm like, I'm going to write this book about karma, purgatory, and witchcraft. And she says, oh, Lordy, son, you need some Jesus in your life. And I said, nah, G-Mom, I'm good with that. I think I'm good. I'm doing enough of God's work here. But not to get on my high horse. But so then I started writing, and I didn't have an outline. I just wrote like 35 pages, and I just had no idea where I was going with it. I just sat down, threw on the headphones, shut everybody out at night. And I only wrote at night because the kids were in bed and not bothering me. And so then it turned into like this, now it's 100 something pages, and it's with the chief editor at the publishing company. And I wrote my daughter in as one of the main characters. And so it's incredible. So, and then
I bet grandma's looking forward to reading this one.
Oh no, she it's actually pretty crazy. And I told my doctor at the VA, I said, you don't want to read that. I said, you'll lock me up, because I had to create purgatory. I mean, you know, so it's like a very sadistic thing. And I was like, no, you don't want to read it. But it was actually great, because it allowed me to pass time through COVID, through the pandemic. Yes. So it was really beneficial that I listened to that voice of my publisher and not shut him out. So it was good.
Where did all of it come from? The inspiration for that one? Karma, purgatory, and witchcraft.
So it was really weird. So my roommate at the Padres Fantasy Camp snored really loud. And so normally I could pretty much tune it out with like...
Was that your roommate?
No. I won't say his name because he might get mad. But he snored so loud that I couldn't tune him out with like just an earbud and something playing in the background, right? And so I put on my like noise canceling headphones and like white noise. And I had the weirdest dreams. And so I got up in the middle of the night and standing there in the bathroom texting myself while I'm peeing, you know, what these dreams were about. And then I came to be. So it's pretty crazy, man.
Oh my goodness. That is super wild. So let's get back to the first book, There and Back Again. It's not a war story, but obviously it starts because of the war in Iraq. And it's really a story of perseverance, grit, tenacity, coping, and kind of, as I came to know you, really fighting for what's rightfully yours. And we can get into the bureaucracy and all of that. And I know the story very intimately of how you earned the Bronze Star with Valor. And I was very honored to be at the award ceremony on the USS Midway. And it was just incredibly special, especially not only knowing the story itself, but what you went through and how long it took to be awarded for the sacrifice. And for people that don't know your story, and there's a lot out there that don't, and their mind's going to be blown, would you mind sharing the story of the one that earned you the Bronze Star with Valor? And I know you shared it a ton, and I know it's heavy. It's heavy. So like explicit, it's quite explicit, and it'll turn your stomach a little bit, but it's incredible heroism.
Well, that day, February 25th, 2006, we were just weeks away from coming home, and we were training the Iraqi army. And our mission that day was to take a squad of Iraqi army out. And at that point, we had trained them enough where they could patrol in the city on their own. And so what we were doing was doing bounding overwatch, watching over them as they patrol, and basically just seeing them practice in like the real world kind of a thing. So it'd be like a doctor like going in the OR, and his supervisors are just up watching him kind of a thing. So we drop off the Iraqi army. They're doing their thing. I'm driving the medevac Humvee that day. And one of the Humvees gets hit by an IED and blows the engine block out. Nobody's injured. So I give up the Humvee that I'm driving to the group, the squad, so they can maintain squad integrity. So if something else happens, like they're an element that's together. So then I hop in the rear gun truck while we're protecting the down Humvee, waiting for the basically tow truck to come out and pick it up. And we take enemy fire from the insurgents. So it's basically an ambush. And so I hop in the rear gun truck as we're returning to base. And which wasn't supposed to be the rear gun truck. That was supposed to be the second to last gun truck. And so, but there was a malfunction with the machine gun that day. So that became the rear gun truck. And I'm sitting behind the driver, and the Marine next to me says, "Doc, you need to sit here. It's statistically the safest seat in the vehicle, and it's reserved for VIPs." And I said, "No, man, if anything happens, I'd rather be me than you. It's roll of the dice anyways." And so we start heading back to base, and then IED goes off, control detonated. And I feel the Humvee being lifted in the air. Everything goes like black from the smoke cloud, everything, right? And well, I didn't know it at the time, but shrapnel like entered my sunglasses, my Oakleys, and like melted them. So like it was crazy. I thought I was blind for a few minutes there. But the Humvee goes up in the air and then falls on its side. But as we're being lifted in the air, I think to myself, "Holy shit, we just got hit by an IED. And then my next thought was, "Holy shit, I'm alive," thinking that we just got hit by an IED. So my mind immediately goes to work that there's going to be massive casualties. And I haven't seen anything yet. It's just like black. So we land, and I look over to my right, the guy's gone. He's not in the Humvee anymore. My med bag's just obliterated. It was like a big green med bag that I had next to me.
That's your toolkit.
Yeah. Okay. So I feel my legs, everything, and I feel bleeding. So I get two tourniquets out. I had like a trauma pouch on my leg that I had strapped to my leg. I had a trauma pouch and I tied the tourniquets on and I radioed in my position because I knew that if I didn't stop the bleeding and I died, I wouldn't be able to help my Marine. So I had to like stop the bleeding, get to work. I radioed in my position and my Marine said, "Doc, get to Lunac, Lunac's down," which, well, we'll not use his name in here, but you know.
What's Lunac?
He was my gunner.
Gotcha, okay.
Yeah, and so at that time, like before that, I even noticed my sunglasses were all mangled and everything, and I climb out of the Humvee, and I didn't know this at the time. Shattered forearm, fingers mangled, I couldn't feel my legs. I had a fractured back, I had a fractured neck. The Navy neglected to tell me about that, but we'll get into that later.
Of course they did.
Yeah, mild concussion. My eardrums like completely obliterated. Like everything was just a wreck, right? And I'm sitting on top of this Humvee. It's flipped over on its side, sitting on top, and I start getting shot at. And so my Marines tell me, I don't remember doing this. They said they looked over and they saw me just beating my chest like the Hulk, yelling at the insurgents, "Come get me, mother." Yeah, and
you so don't remember any of this.
No, no. And they were like, "Go get Doc." So by that time, one of the guys, the gunner that was next to me, he fell out and the Humvee almost landed on him. So it would have crushed and killed him. But luckily, he gets up and starts getting all the explosives out of the Humvee because he smelled smoldering, you know, like the Humvee was starting to catch fire.
Okay.
And starts throwing smoke grenades to conceal our cover while the other Marines come out and get me off the Humvee. And then I have my Marines take me into the courtyard, place me against the wall of the courtyard where I'm facing my Marine, my turret gunner. He's screaming in pain. And so I give him 10 milligrams of morphine intramuscularly. So it's going to take a few minutes to hit him. So then I try and get my last tourniquet out of my pocket. Then I realize my fingers were mangled. And so I'm looking at my fingers and I just rip one of them off and I just throw it in the other courtyard. I'm like, this
your
is
finger.
Dead. Yeah.
You ripped your finger off and chucked it.
Oh yeah. I was like, no, this thing's useless to me. Even if they find it, they reattach it, it's going to be useless. Like it'll never work the way I want it to again.
Were you thinking that? I mean, in hindsight, yeah. At the time, I mean, you're standing on the Humvee and you're beating on your chest like King Kong and they have to get you down. And then you see your finger, your head, you were obviously out of your mind at this point. Right? Like what was the headspace like that you were in? And then we'll keep the story can you remember any of it?
It was just work. I had a job I needed to do. And my focus was my Marines and maintaining that calm order. Because it was said in our training that if the corpsmen freak out and lose our headspace, the Marines start freaking out.
Yeah.
So if I start freaking out saying, "Oh my God, I can't do this. I can't," you know, then they're going to lose it. And then they're not going to be there. So, so I just knew I needed to do whatever it took to calm this Marine down.
And I know you had been on a bunch of missions before this one, and you were coming up on the end of a 7-month tour. Was this your first run-in? Was this your first real experience with combat, or there had been others, and so you were kind of a hardened combat vet at this point?
Oh yeah, I had over 225 combat patrols at that point, and right. I saw some mass casualty. I treated wounded Marines, I treated wounded Iraqi Army, wounded civilians. So at that point, like I had a lot of experience.
What was your learning curve like from the first patrol up until this moment, 226 or whatever it was, to get you to the point where you're capable of handling this kind of impact, this kind of trauma?
So we were quick reaction force. couple, like multiple times throughout the month in the city. So I treated Marines with gunshot wounds, stab wounds, blast injuries to include grenades and IEDs, landmines. And so at that point, I already had experience. And January 5th of 2006, I saved, I think it was like 59 Iraqi Army and U.S. coalition and civilian lives that day from two suicide detonated vests. And so I already had the mind space that I could do it.
So that's its own story. Yeah. No awards for that one, though.
I got one, but they said if it would have been U.S. lives, U.S. military lives, it would have been a Medal of Honor. So that's that bureaucracy that we, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Jeez.
But yeah, so I ended up ripping my finger off, and I remember knowing at the time that this finger is useless to me. It's done. I don't want it ever again. I'm going to leave it here. I don't care. And so I left it. I threw it in.
What was it held on by?
I think a couple ligaments, but it was not really attached. I mean, I could just flick it, and it was.
How much, what were you feeling at the time?
I didn't feel any pain at the time.
Yeah.
It was, I think the adrenaline, with like shock, like the nerves and the concussion, I think it all just kind of like numbed me, like physically. And I think it numbed me emotionally too at the time.
I'm sure.
And because I'll get into that in a second. But so I ended up getting the tourniquet out of my pocket because I just needed to open one button. That's all I needed was one button. So I ended up getting it open. And then the, hold on, sorry, somebody's calling me. I get it out, I tighten it on him, and then I start dressing other wounds and everything. And meanwhile, I'm telling the other corpsman to listen to my voice. I'll guide him because his best friend was killed in the incident. So, you know, it was like, I understood, but I'm like, hey, we got to maintain. We'll deal with that later. Let's rock and roll. We have other jobs to do. So, but I helped him, and I'm trying to get him a backdated award, but again, that's more political nonsense. But by that time, the other corpsman, the quick reaction force corpsman, gets there, and I knew that it was going to be okay because he and I worked together multiple times before in the deployment, and I knew like he was good. And so he shows up, he assesses me, I tell him to get away. I'm good. And he didn't
even
think
somebody else.
Yeah, he didn't even really think I was injured because he was like, you were just so calm. And, you know, he's like, some of the other guys were freaking out. And, you know, so they put me on a stretcher, or they tried to put me on a stretcher. I denied it. I had them carry me into the Humvee. So my Marine had the stretcher, and I had them place me again. So I was looking at him and able to do work. And I did that all the way to the hospital base on, or the base hospital on Camp Ramadi. But by that time, one of the other units had got hit in the city that day, like just 10, 15 minutes before us in another part. And they requested a helicopter evacuation. So by the time they even assessed me at the hospital, it was just more of like, no internal bleeding. Your heart, your lungs are good. Good. You're on the helicopter out. So, and then from there, it was like a 45-minute ride to Balad. And at that point, I could start to feel the pain in my hand. Like, I was like, okay, now this is starting to hurt. And
your body started to gear down from the adrenaline and the shock, and it started to wear off, yeah. Had you taken any morphine at that point?
No, I gave Bolsterets to my turret gunner. And so, because we were only allowed to carry two, so I gave them both to him. And we were on the bird together, but I was like looking at my hand, and I could see the bone and all the ligaments and stuff. And I was like, okay, this should hurt. And then I think that's when it, you know, like, okay, But I, like you said, I think my body finally calmed down, the blood pressure, my heart rate. And then it was like, oh, okay, this, yeah. And then I got into Balad Surgical, and there, the triage room was just full of troops. And so I told the nurses, I said, look, I'm good. I can wait a couple hours, get everybody else in. Just hook me up with some meds. They hooked me up with some meds. I flirted with the nurses, and you know, then
and that'll make you feel better.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, what better than pumping me full of pain meds and just sit there? And they had a TV in the triage room, so I was like watching TV, and I was,
you know, just real casual, just winding down after a day's work.
Yeah, but then they wheeled me. They came and got me. The anesthesiologist pushed some med, and I went black, and I woke up in Bethesda with my dad standing over me. So I was like, okay, this is good. I know where I'm at now.
From that point in Iraq where you're getting treated, you woke up next in Bethesda, Maryland.
Yep. Yeah.
Was it like a medically induced coma? Is that what they did? I mean, how did that work?
I think it was. My dad later told me that he got a phone call saying that he needed to come to Germany to say goodbye to me because I wasn't stable enough to make the flight. And so he's like trying to figure all that out. He's freaking out. But by the time he figured that out, he got a phone call from the military saying, hey, your son's stable. Like, we're going to try and put him on a bird and fly him back to the States and get him to a combat like ortho surgeon, trauma surgeon. And so then I was so messed up. My dad and my grandma beat me to the hospital. So they made it to Bethesda, and they were in the waiting room, and they brought five of us in on a bus and the gurneys, five of us through, and they didn't even recognize me. And so my dad like was freaking out, and he's like, where's my son? You know, I just saw you close the doors to the bus. Like, where's my son? And they were like, oh, we wheeled him past. And years later, my buddy Kurt, who was working ICU as a corpsman, he told me, he said that I coded in the elevator on the way up to the ICU. He
coded, you went flatline.
Yeah. He said that I went flatline, and he said that, I was like, why didn't you tell me about this? And he said, I didn't want to worry you or freak you out. So he said, I wanted to wait until you're like good in your recovery. But he said it was a good thing my dad and my grandma didn't see me in the hospital in the big waiting area, because they would have like been in the elevator with me. And so,
no kidding.
That was a blessing in disguise. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so where from there? I mean, what year was that one? After
I got to Bethesda, February 28, 2006.
Okay.
And I transferred to San Diego I got into San Diego May 8th of 2006.
Okay.
And then I did 2 years of recovery at Balboa.
2 years. And you were at Balboa. Were you staying at Balboa, or were you staying off campus and then coming back on a daily basis, or what was going on during that time? And I know you talked about the neck, the back, you shattered the forearm, you had the fingers. I also know, and I shared in the intro, that you're an amputee below the knee. You know, there's foot things. I mean, you've got a crazy amount of, tell everybody, I mean, how many surgeries are we talking about? What surgeries are we talking about? Because we were set to climb Mount Kilimanjaro in 2017, in the spring of 2017, and you had to miss because of another surgery. And that was when I remember hearing the number, I thought, goodness gracious, I'm at 11. And I thought that was a lot. But when you said it, I almost threw up.
Yeah. I just had, in March, I just had my 85th surgery.
85th.
Yeah. And that's stateside. I don't even know how many I had overseas.
85 surgeries. Oh, and you had some overseas, like while you were kind of out of it.
Yeah. So I know I had one in Balad, and then I at least had two in Germany. So I'm probably pushing 90 surgeries.
What? It's hard to comprehend, right? I mean, like 90 surgeries since 2006. That's 15 years. I mean, I'm not very good at math, but it's like 7 a year. 8 a year.
That's average six a year.
Good night. And
my first 3 months, I had 32 surgeries in Bethesda.
In 3 months, you were averaging 10 surgeries a month for 3 months. And what kind of surgeries are we talking about here?
Most of them were washing cleanouts, because, okay. And I'll tell you why they do that. So overseas at the time, especially in Ramadi, they had the Iraqis had their like outhouses essentially, right? But they didn't have like sewers or whatever. Like it just ran into the streets. So you think how much of that and all that bacteria.
A lot of bacteria.
Yeah. So then you get hit by IED and you get all that dirt and all of that human waste. And then you got to count in dogs and sheep and goats and cows and birds.
Yeah, completely unsanitary.
Yeah. And then so every other day for so long I was in the OR, they were doing wash and clean out. So I was pretty well out of it for like the first month. And it was pretty bad.
A wash and a clean out, what is that? I mean, I'm assuming they're opening the wound and they're scrubbing it out and
basically just scrubbing it out and spraying it, essentially literally spraying it with like saline, and you're on the strongest antibiotics and until like they feel that you're comfortable and they can see like your tissue healing and coming together. Yeah. But then my right foot was so messed up. And so it's kind of funny. I sat down with the ortho surgeon and I showed him my x-rays of my left and right foot, because I came home with my left foot too. And I said, if you had to choose, which leg would you amputate? And he said, speaking by x-ray, it'd be your right foot. And that's the foot that I still have.
You have what? On your right foot, you have two toes remaining?
Two toes.
And which ones are they?
The big toe and the second toe.
Okay. And they're fixed, you said?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's still plans for 1 to 2 more surgeries on that foot.
Okay.
But that can be spread out over a couple of years. But so my right foot, the compression of the blast, like blew some of the soft tissue off. Like just, I mean, you know how it is. Like you get struck by lightning, their energy comes in, energy has to go out, right?
I don't know. I do not know how it is, but I do. Yes, yes. No, I don't want to know how that is.
Well, you're a bull, you know.
Yeah.
But LaDainian Tomlinson, he could tell you about energy.
You tell me what that feels like.
Yeah, he goes in and out of the D line.
Oh, yeah, no, thank you.
Yeah, but the pressure of the blast disintegrated one of my metatarsals in my in my foot, like just annihilated it. And then, but the soft tissue, and the craziest thing is my dad was handed a trash bag when I got to the States, and they said, this can't be in the hospital, it's full of bacteria, whatever. And my dad goes back to the Navy Lodge hours later, goes back to the Navy Lodge, and he pulls it out, and it's my combat boots. He reaches inside my right combat boot and pulls out a flesh, like a chunk of my foot. And so it was like so strange. And he's like, why didn't they look for that? Like, that's so crazy, you know? But he ended up getting them cleaned and bronzed. Him and my grandma got them bronzed and put on a plaque and everything. And
the boots, not the tissue.
Yeah, yeah, the boots.
Yeah.
It's so crazy, because I want to donate those boots to the Marine Corps museum one day. But
cool.
it's so crazy because my right foot, they had to keep it like wrapped in saran wrap essentially until a plastic surgeon could figure out a game plan. And it took them over a month to figure out a plan. And he came in and he said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. And he told me, he said he's going to take a flap from my right thigh and then place it on my right foot and hope that it works. So basically like a tissue transfer. Mm-hmm. And he said, but I need you to promise me that you're going to do everything you can to save this foot. And so I made that promise. And here today, a little over 15 years later, exactly, I still have my right foot. And yeah.
And why the promise? Why did he ask for that?
So he said that I think the OR time was like 12 to 14 hours. And then I had to go back into the ICU. And then it was very uncertain. So it was, I think he wanted me to make a promise to him, but in turn, make a promise to me, like that I would, he's doing all this work and I'm putting all this like mental work into saving this foot that I need to, yeah. I need to save it. And
you need to fight for this.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, yeah, sure. And yeah, to this day, it's still, I've had a couple revisions done on the flap because when they did it, my foot was 8 inches across, like it was so swollen. And so as time goes on, you know, my foot eventually got shrunken down. And so I've had to have a couple revisions where they just go in and do almost like a tummy tuck, like a tissue.
Excess tissue.
Yeah. Yeah. So they did that. I think I've had like 3 revisions on that. But then back to when I met you and we were going to climb Kilimanjaro, I had to have microfracture on my knee. And yeah. I remember talking to you about it, and that was a tough decision not to go, because you were like, look, the mountain will be there. So
the mountain will definitely be there. And look, in 2020, right, you accomplished climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. You were team leader for Water Boys and led the charge up the mountain, and you got it done. What was that like? What was it like for you? I wish we would have done it together, man.
Oh, I know, but I'm pretty sure you don't want to. Would you ever do it again?
Heck yeah, I would do it again. That was awesome. That was the experience of my life, man. That was, and getting to do it with, it wasn't with you, but with Kirsty Ennis and Ivan Castro and Pete Quintanilla. And it was so special just to get to spend time with wounded veterans. And Kirsty was the first female above the knee amputee to summit the mountain. And Ivan was the first completely blind person to summit Mount Kilimanjaro. So that was super rad. And then Pete was really unique because Pete had attempted it before and he had made it up to the ridge, and the group that he was with, they all decided to come back down after that, where they were like 2 miles short of just kind of walking that crest around. But you know, when you get up to that ridge and you get over the top and everyone gets super emotional because you think you're there, and then everyone points at that sign that's 2 miles around the canyon rim and they go, you got another hour and a half, 2 hours of work to do. People kind of freak out. So it was huge. And I got to spend crazy amounts of time with Pete. And then that was really cool to see him kind of overcome his previous experience and do that. And then Ivan was super special too, because we had a lot of folks that were having like bad issues with the altitude, and his partner was a Green Beret. And he was an incredible guy. He flew in from, I think he was in like PI or something, and he flew in to do this with Ivan, but he didn't have any of the good medicine or anything. So he didn't have like the Diamox and he didn't have the prednisone. And so he started like bleeding out of his eye as we're climbing up the mountain. And he's like, I gotta go down. He's coughing up blood. He's like, I gotta go down. Can you take Ivan? And so I gotta help steer Ivan up the mountain, and then everyone basically left. And so it was like me and Ivan coming down the mountain, and Pete was with us, and it was so amazing to like get a shepherd, a blind dude, up and down a mountain. It was like, what a grateful experience for me to spend that good time with him.
Yeah, especially Kilimanjaro. I mean, that one, oh man, that summit night, that was brutal.
What, that was a long day.
That was like 16 to 18 hours. I was like, yeah.
And they get you too, because when you come back down, they're like, your tents are all gone. You think you're going to, and then it's like, no, you got to keep going. And they're like, how far is it? And nobody ever says how far it is. It's like, just tell me how far it is. At least I felt like it was another, it took us, I'm not kidding, I think we left at like 10 at night. We got back, I think it was like 8 at night. It was dark when we got to that other, which with the other campsite was super cool. I thought we were on our way out of the entire park that night, but it was like, no, you camp here. And then you got another day that you got to haul.
That second, that last day is like 14 miles and you're just like, oh.
And you're so over it. It's like, I stink so bad. I can't wait to wash myself. Oh.
You see the rainforest and you're like, oh, I'm almost there. And then it's like another 7 miles through the rainforest and you're like,
you're not almost there. You forget how long that journey up through it was.
Oh yeah.
It's almost like you wish you had a paraglider at the top of the mountain and I could just like, let's go. I'll be down in 20 minutes.
Oh man. So I didn't tell Chris or anybody for a while, but until after I did it, I donated my left kidney November 5th of 2019.
Right.
And
that's right.
I gave Chris my commitment. I said, I'm doing this. And because he had already counted on it, and I gave him my word. And so I told him after I knew I was healed and ready to go, and that I was good.
Who'd you give your kidney to again?
So I donated, I donated it to a random person, but it was for a chain donation. I forgot, Armani Bryant. He was on Yahoo
Football
Sports.
Player.
Yeah. He was on Yahoo Sports. And so I talked to Nate Boyer and was like, hey, can I get a hold of Armani Bryant? I don't know how to get a hold of him, but, you know, I see he needs a kidney. And I've been working up the process to donate a kidney. And within an hour, Nate got me his contact info. And I texted Armani and I'm like, hey, bro, you don't know me, but, you know, I'm cleared to donate a kidney. You know, I want to see if we're a match. And we weren't. But he was like, would you still consider donating just so I could get higher on the list? And I said, absolutely, man. And so I texted him as I was leaving the hospital. And I'm like, hey, I'm good to go. The recipient's good. And the doctor says my kidney and me is working, and my kidney and the other person's working really good. So I'm going home and wish you all the best, man. And so, but yeah.
After all of this, after we haven't even talked about the decision to get rid of the left foot. So you got rid of part of the right. You're fighting for that. You've had 90 surgeries almost. And then we're going to now, what, like 4 or 5 months before you go to Kilimanjaro to hike up a 19,000, I think it's 481 or something like that, foot mountain. I'm going to donate my kidney. What?
Yeah. And in 2018, I climbed and I had altitude sickness. So I was like, okay, this is going to be interesting.
What did your wife say when you said, I want to donate a kidney? What was she like? What, how'd that go?
There was a fight.
I bet. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I told her, I said, I gave my commitment and I'm a man of my word and I'm going to do this. And so I did. And there was a bit of a fight, because in true Doc Jacobs fashion, I gave my word to Gary Sinise Foundation that I was going to go to an event in Vegas. So I literally left the hospital days before the doctor recommended me to
go to an event.
I was on a flight to Vegas the day after I got out of the hospital. Oh man. I,
You're the giving tree. Do you know the poem? Do you know the poem, The Giving Tree?
Yeah, it's.
You're the giving tree. It's unbelievable. I mean, there was two moments in the story in Ramadi when one, you gave up your seat when you weren't, I'm assuming you weren't supposed to. You gave up your stretcher. You gave up your place in line when it comes to the hospital. You give up your kidney. You know, it's what is, have you done a deep psychological dive? Like what's going on in Doc Jacobs' head? Like what makes you?
I just know that I came home for a reason, and I was a very giving person to begin with. I never really asked for anything. I just put my head down. I work hard. I don't really ask for anything. And I don't know. I always see a need. I guess I'm a true Libra. Like I just sit back and observe, and I can feel people's energy, I guess, yeah, without getting like too hippie with it. But
no, I feel you.
So I don't know. I've just always been a giving person. And so there was actually times where I wanted to give more, I guess. Like that kidney donation had been in the works for years. I was actually going to donate to a guy out in South Carolina, and I did all the workups. That's why I told Nate, I was like, look, I'm good to go. I've been cleared to donate a kidney, but I just haven't found the right reason to, other than like, you know, donate a kidney, save a life. But I think that was like my good to go thing. So, but I don't know. I've always been a giving person, and in doing so, like I'm writing these, co-authoring these books for free. I don't want any money from it. I'm medically retired. So I just, you know, just want to help people out and share their story. And then I'm also, I started my foundation. We're 3.5 years running and very productive. And so.
Doc, we talked about it at the beginning as we were kind of talking about exercise in the future and not beating yourself up too bad. And, you know, I can't help but ask, do you worry about your future physically? What's going to be left of you or the state of repair as you age? Cause how old are you now?
I'll be 36 in September. So,
wow. You're so young.
Yeah. And I've had four, surgeries on my left knee. While I was rehabbing the microfracture on my left knee, I tore meniscus on my right knee. So I'm feeling it a little bit, but I don't know. I'm just trying to stay at a good, healthy weight and do just like body weight workouts. So that way I'm not jamming my joints, I guess.
And I think that's very smart. Yeah. And I think number one, the healthy weight is super smart to take the stress off the joints as well as you possibly can. And then, but you do have to keep moving, right? I mean, you have to keep working, one, mostly for your brain, so your brain doesn't atrophy. And then two, motion is lotion when it comes to a lot of things, but you've got a very challenged circumstance with all of the surgeries that you've been through, like how much meat's left on the bone.
Yeah. And it's tough. And I listen to a lot of the Vietnam veterans, and they say, don't stop moving. Mm-hmm. They say, when you stop moving, your joints start to ache and seize up. And so, like you said, motion is lotion, and that's for your joints. But for me, right around Thanksgiving of last year, I had a nerve stimulator put in my back because that fracture to L3 and then a little bit of arthritis is starting to kick in. And I'm like, okay, well, this isn't good. So, and then, which kind of makes me mad that the Navy didn't tell me that I fractured my neck and my back in the blast. And I'm finding out years later. And I mean, it was like right in my medical record. I was still in my coma on March 1st, 2006, they did a CT, but then they didn't tell my dad, they didn't tell my grandma. And so then I'm you know, I find out years later. And of course I find that out after my Bronze Star, which is, you know, I'm fighting for an upgrade on that. But
are you now fighting for what's up above a Bronze Star? Medal of Honor? Is there anything? Okay.
Which is what it was originally submitted for, the Navy Cross and the Medal of Honor. So,
okay.
Tell me a little bit, Doc, we don't have a ton of time, but tell me a little bit, would you, about the process of, and I know you're fighting for the Silver Star. Tell me a little bit about the process of getting the Bronze Star with Valor and how long that took and kind of everything that went into that, because it was kind of wild from what you told me.
It was a lengthy process. And after 5 years, you have to go through Congress. So after 5 years of the incident, it has to go through, you have to get a congressional endorsement. So I went to one congressman, just flat out denied it. Former Marine Corps officer, Iraq vet, and two tours.
Just straight denied it.
Yeah. And no guidance on like, hey, you need this paperwork. You need, just straight out denied it. And then another congressman, I don't know how he got reelected. He denied it. Just didn't even, the denial letter was sent with like just bits and pieces. So it wasn't like a full 5 pages. It was like, I got page one that was like barely scanned and missing words. And it was just horrible. And so finally went through Scott Peters' office, and his people really helped me out and told me what I needed from the chain of command, how to go about it. And then once I got the packet submitted through my chain of command approved it, and then it went through him. So it was a couple of years in the making just to get the awards branch to look at it and then vote on it and then send it back. So yeah, but now I'm submitting evidence of my fractured neck and back from March 1st of 2006. So it's not like I'm finding out from a VA MRI 15 years later that...
Right.
It was at the time.
Yeah. And, you know, so I had to submit that. And then a notarized statement from one of my corporals somehow missed the award packet stating that everything I did that day was under secondary enemy fire, which automatically puts you in the realm of a Silver Star. So it's, that was left out of the awards packet. So that was sent to the awards branch through Congressman Scott Peters on March 29th. Yeah. And he said that the Navy has 30 days to respond to him. So, yeah.
How important is that to you at this point?
It's important to me because it tells my story, which inspires other veterans. And it, not only that, but it's like my kids are coming to an age where my daughter, she'll be 8 this year, my son will be 4. So it's like they're starting to understand like what dad went through, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And it's,
and that's important for them to understand that. It's very important for them to understand that.
And it's also for the platform of like my foundation, my writing books, and it allows me to do more for veterans. So, but it also brings the closure to me and my guys. And you were there at the Bronze Star ceremony, how emotional it was when I just talked about the family of one of the fallen guys being there. Yeah. Like that was, I was basically bawling on the stage. And so it brings a lot of closure to all of us. And so overall, big picture, that's why it's important.
Yeah, you get to be the torchbearer in all of this. Yeah, for them, for the guys, for the story, for the battle. It's when, you know, I don't hear a lot of veterans sharing their story like in great detail, like you've shared your story. And some of the guys that have wonderful books out there and they've done a really nice job. It's, and I remember reading the book Tribe, and it's a Sebastian Younger book. And in it, they talk about the importance of veterans being able to come back and not only with other veterans share their story, but with civilians share their story and what that does for their psyche and the acceptance of coming back and the praise that you get when you're coming back into reintegrating into the world. Is that accurate? Is it all important to you to share your story and for civilians like me to look not at you with admiration, but thanks and appreciation for what you've gone through for us? Because when I hear your story and I think you are such a giving person, you're an empathetic person, your sacrifices are, I'd be hard pressed to say that they're matched frequently. It's very, very uncommon. And is that important to you for us civilians to really appreciate the work and the sacrifice that you and your family have gone through for us?
Yeah, I think it's important. And I've wanted to bridge that gap of civilian military understanding of like what we go through, because it's not, everybody sees like helicopters flying over by Pendleton and the brand new shiny F-35s taking off from Miramar and the big aircraft carriers out at sea. And yeah, they see like all this, like, you know, awesome, cool stuff, but
glamorous.
Yeah. But a lot of us, yeah, that are in the trenches per se, you know, I mean, we go through a lot, and I think it's important to share what we go through. And it's also healing for me to share my story and talk about it, but it's also healing for other veterans to know that, hey, Doc Jacobs has gone through some horrible stuff. So I know I can talk to him. And before we get off the line here, I met a Columbia, South Carolina fire rescueman. And we were having some beers a couple nights ago and just shooting the breeze. And by me sharing my story, he opened up and started sharing his stories and talking. And I gave him my card and I said, if you need to talk anytime, man, let me know. And he said, I will be calling you. And so it's a all around healing factor, because mm-hmm. we all go through trauma, whether it's combat or ICU nurses or COVID ward nurses, like we all go through trauma. And so I think it's important to share and just come together as a community.
I agree. I think vulnerability is one of the most powerful things that we can offer. And putting your story out there, putting yourself out there, your weaknesses out there. I oftentimes share my story of transition with guys coming out of the National Football League. And it was brutal. And I thought I had it all dialed in. I had a job, I had a career lined up. I had lost all my weight. I had reclaimed my health. And all of a sudden I'm trying to check out and leave my wife everything but a little bit of money, and I'm going to Nicaragua, right? It's like that was everything. In saying that, it was everything but saying I'm going to kill myself, because I couldn't bring myself to say that, but that's more or less what I'm saying. And then when you share that with other guys, you one, let them know, okay, this is real. Like, this is going to be a process. It's going to be a journey, and it's going to be hard, and it's okay that it's going to be hard. And then two, it's okay to feel this way. It's okay. And it's normal. It's normal to feel this way. From a mental health standpoint, where are you on the journey of getting over? Do you still relive these episodes in the 226 plus combat missions?
I do, but it's very seldom now. I feel like I'm pretty far removed from it, and it's taken a lot of healing to get to where I am. But I had to go through prolonged exposure therapy to get there, which is running a mental marathon. And that was just like one combat incident for that 15 weeks. But I feel that I keep my schedule so busy that I don't allow myself to think about Iraq or the incidences that it's, it happened. I need to live for the guys that couldn't come home. And so I kind of got into a little bit of emotional stuff with a South Carolina firefighter. And we were talking and I told him, I said, man, I harbored so much. I held in so much emotions because I had those memories, those last memories of those guys. And it took me 5+ years to talk to their families and like go share those last moments with them. And I said, it was like, I felt guilty, that survivor's guilt, that I felt guilty that I had those memories and their family didn't. And so it also took me years to understand that the my guys would want me to live in their honor. So I named my son after them, like, you know, so he's going to have that legacy. And, but it took me years to understand that, but also get that guilt out and share that with those families, because I felt guilty that I saw their faces right before the blast went off. Like I saw their smiles before the blast went off, and it hurt me so much that I had that, but the families didn't. And so I flew to Minnesota and I sat on my buddy's grave with his sister and his nieces and nephews and told them of his last moments. I took his childhood buddies on a deep sea fishing trip and told them. And then I sat down and had coffee with the other family and I invited them to the Bronze Star ceremony. And it took a lot to heal to get there, but I feel like now I've graduated and I'm a healer now. So I can help others, but it took a lot to get that PhD. So, yeah.
And isn't it, I guess,
very fortuitous that a Navy corpsman is a healer?
Yeah.
In life. Like that's yeah. It's just what you are.
Yeah. And I think that's what drew me to be a corpsman was I knew that that was what I needed to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did.
You were placed. You were selectively placed.
Well, I trust in God's bigger plan.
Yeah.
Which is also why I never used my truck bed camping setup that I got. And I was going to get a state park pass and go travel the country and just live out of the back of my truck. And like you said, just leave it all to the family. But yeah, so I'm glad I didn't listen to that voice and glad you didn't either.
Hey, now you can take the kids camping. Yeah. Don't do it. Hey, don't do that by yourself. Now you start camping by yourself, I'm going to give you a phone call. Yeah. So Doc, what's next? What's next for you?
I got a lot on the plate.
Yes.
Forward, ever forward, right? By the way, I agree with the philosophy that, you know, you can move past the past if you just keep charging ahead. Yeah.
Marines never retreat. So, but I mean, I'm doing a lot of writing, and I'm actually, trying out for Paralympic bobsledding. So I know that's crazy. And, I got a TV show in the works that I've been working on for over a year now, and hopefully that comes to play. So just busy and just enjoying the kids while they're young. I mean, they grow up so fast. I mean, my daughter's playing softball and doing swim at the same time, and she's in a class like above her age, and she's kicking those kids' butts. And so it's incredible, but yeah.
Fantastic. Lastly, can I give you a piece of advice? It's okay to make money. Don't feel bad about making money, man. I know you're medically retired. I get it. You're 36, but it's okay. It's okay to make money for the work that you're putting in. You have to value yourself.
Yeah. Well, I know, for me, I'm actually getting my first paid speaking engagement coming up Friday. So
better, babe. Good. And I hope that's the beginning of a very fruitful speaking engagement career, because you need this story out there and you're super inspiring, and that's a fantastic path, man.
Well, thanks, brother. I'll send you a copy of my commencement speech when I when I'm completed today. So
awesome. Doc, hey, love you, buddy. I appreciate you. Where can people follow you?
You can follow me either foundation website, docjacobsfoundation.org. I have Instagram, Doc Jacobs Author, Twitter, Doc Jacobs, The Doc Jacobs, Facebook, just Doc Jacobs. And then, yeah, you can follow me on Amazon as well, because I'm going to be publishing more books. Like, and yeah,
plural.
Yeah, oh, yeah. It's a process writing books and editing, and but yeah, but it's all good stuff, brother.
Hey, I'm proud to know you.
I appreciate it, and I'm blessed that we met 5 years ago now.
And yeah, it has been. Yeah, time flies.
And when that silver star comes to fruition, you got to be there.
Count me in. I'll be there. I'm on the Doc Jacobs ride, man.
Oh yeah. Hopefully it's at Petco Park and the Padres show some love. So
they will.
Yeah. Yeah. They're good.
Yes, they are. Yeah. They do a great job.
Yeah. America's a military team. So
yeah. Well, hey, thank you, Doc, for the time.
All right. Appreciate you, brother.
All right, buddy. Love you. Take care.